and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the letter today from 30 GOP lawmakers who served in Congress saying they would not vote for Donald Trump in the general election, stating, "Every day brings a fresh revelation that highlights the unacceptable danger of electing Trump to lead our nation." One of the signatories, former Republican Congressman Tom Campbell, joins us to discuss why he signed the letter and how he was motivated to do so by Trump's remark that implied an invitation to violence against Hillary Clinton by so-called Second Amendment people. With both moderate and conservative Republican lawmakers having signed the letter, we will look into a likely post-mortem conducted by the GOP, if there is to be a Trump defeat, to determine the future direction of the Republican Party that could see a return to a more moderate path or a deal between traditional conservatives and the Tea Party wing to pursue less radical and more conservative policies. Then we'll get an analysis of the unusually sharp rebuke issued Wednesday by the White House and the State Department over Israel's plans to build brand new settlements on the West Bank, with White House spokesman Josh Earnest suggesting the Netanyahu government broke its word. Quote, "We did receive public assurances from the Israeli government that contradict this announcement. I guess when we're talking about how good friends treat one another, that's a source of serious concern." The former spokesman for the late Shimon Peres, Gideon Levy, now a journalist and columnist with Haaretz, joins us to discuss how the U.S. does not use its leverage over Israel, which would have happened before the generous arms deal Obama just gave the Israelis, not after, when Netanyahu can thumb his nose in Obama's face. Then finally, we will speak with Brendan O'Boyle, an editor of America's Quarterly, where he has an article, "Did an anti-LGBT panic help defeat Colombia's peace deal?" He joins us to discuss how the recent firing of Colombia's openly gay Minister of Education, who had become a lightning rod for the conservative opposition, only to have President Santos appoint her as a coordinator of the Yes campaign for the peace deal with the FARC, helped tip the scales in the No campaign's direction in Sunday's referendum that had an historically low turnout. And joining us now is Congressman Tom Campbell, who is a Republican congressman who was the representative of California's 15th congressional district from 1995 to 2000. And prior to that, he represented California's 12th congressional district from 1989 to 1992. He's a former dean and currently professor at the Chapman University School of Law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tom Campbell.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And you are one of the signatories, along with a number of prominent Republican congressmen, Bob Bauman, Steve Bartlett, Tom Coleman, Bill Klinger, Jim Colby, Tom Petrie, Mickey Edwards, Bob Inglis, Vin Weber, Dick Zimmer, and former Senator Gordon Humphrey. Why did you sign on to this letter with approximately 30 other former GOP lawmakers?
I had long thought that it was a danger to our country something that should be taken quite seriously, that one of the two major parties had nominated Donald Trump. And I took this position as early as August. In fact, even sooner, right after the California primary. But in August, I put out an op-ed in the San Jose Mercury, which is the principal newspaper in my former congressional district, saying the Republican National Committee should substitute the candidate for president. And at that time, I was very hopeful that that might actually happen. So I had a constructive view here, which was, last August, there was still time. And I particularly focused on Donald Trump's comments. I'm sure you recall them. I'm quoting him, quote, referring to Hillary Clinton, "If she gets to pick her judges, nothing you can do, folks, although the Second Amendment people, maybe there is, I don't know," end quote. That was over the line. I mean, that is just unprecedented, a reference to potentially violent action. And it was stated by Mr. Trump after the convention. So the reason why I stood up then and joined this letter now was truly in a constructive vein to try to see if the Republican National Committee could substitute. After the convention, the Republican National Committee has the authority to substitute, and hoped that they would do so.
Well, the letter is, I think, is very, very strongly stated here. Let me just quote a bit of it. "In nominating Donald Trump, the Republican Party has asked the people of the United States to entrust their future to a man who insults women, mocks the handicapped, urges that dissent be met with violence, seeks to impose religious tests for entry into the United States, and applies a de facto ethnicity test to judges. He offends our allies and praises dictators. His public statements are peppered with lies. He belittles our heroes and insults the parents of men who have died serving our country. Every day brings a fresh revelation that highlights the unacceptable danger in electing him to lead our nation. Very strong words. Now, I guess the question looms, though. Do you think this is making an impression on his followers? It's almost like we're in two different universes here.
I think there's a large number of people, of course, who have already made their mind up. But I think that the outcome of the election is going to be determined by those, let me say, traditional Republicans who would be inclined to vote for the nominee of the Republican Party and who are reflecting on whether Donald Trump is simply unacceptable. And I think there's a few, but probably fewer, on the Democratic side who would traditionally vote for the Democratic nominee, but who have serious trouble with Secretary Clinton, and particularly just focusing on the one aspect of erasing the emails when they were under subpoena. So that's the group that's going to determine the outcome of this election in 5 to 7 critical states. So a statement such as the one that we produced will have an influence perhaps on just that first group to give some comfort to Republicans who might say, well, gee, I'm a loyal Republican. How can I do anything but vote for Donald Trump? And we remind all of those in that group, we're loyal Americans first. And in my view, to recur to the fundamental point, though, there are several important points of concern. What stepped over the line is the rule of law. In addition to the statement he made about the Second Amendment people, he also, at one of the rallies, several actually, but at one rally in particular, said that a dissenter should be beaten up and that he, Donald Trump, would pay the attorney's fees for whoever did it. This is unacceptable, and this, I think, is going to be of some importance to traditional Republicans who might otherwise be unwilling to depart from their loyalty to the party.
Well, surely, though, having said that, as you quoted him at a rally about the Second Amendment folks making that somewhat ambiguous, but nevertheless something that could be interpreted as an incitement to assassinate Hillary Clinton, he followed up on that more recently by suggesting that maybe her bodyguards, who are all armed, should be taken away, and then let's see what happens. Again, it's bad enough to make the statement once, but you would think that, is there anybody around to pull him over, do you think, and educate him about the reckless nature of what he's saying?
First of all, may I say that my own view, you're of course entitled to yours, and I know it's thoughtful, but my own view is just focusing on his contemplating, I'm not going to use the word inciting, but contemplating, where he spoke of the Second Amendment people. But I do agree there are other instances of it, including the reference to the Secret Service pulling aside and see what happens. He also encouraged American troops, when he is commander-in-chief, to use torture, saying that his orders would be obeyed even if the law said to the contrary. With that understood, what he is saying, is there anyone to pull him over? The Republican Party lacks the elder statesman. You might say George Shultz and Henry Kissinger would be what we have in the Republican Party today, former secretaries of state to President Ronald Reagan and President Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford. And they have chosen to be neutral, as you might have noted. Our last nominee for president, Mitt Romney, clearly opposed to Donald Trump. But what's lacking, you might say, are the dominant figures of that a safe space for Republicans, loyal Republicans, lifelong Republicans, to say something went wrong in this present process and our country comes first. When the absence of such spokespersons, you definitely have a commitment to continue right down to Election Day with Donald Trump as the nominee. But I repeat, when I began my efforts in this regard, it was with the very clear intent and hope that the National Republican Committee would actually substitute. And I'll hazard a guess. I have no basis for this, but that's never stopped me in the past. If you were to ask members of the National Republican Committee, would you like to substitute Michael Pence for Donald Trump tomorrow, that you'd have an overwhelming yes vote.
I think that was the sentiment of a lot of people who were watching the debate. But I don't know whether you're making an oblique reference there, Congressman Tom Campbell, to Paul Ryan. But Paul Ryan will be campaigning for Donald Trump on Saturday, the day before the second debate. What's your sense then of, in fact, I spoke with James Fellows recently of The Atlantic, who coined the term, if you will, Vichy Republicans, which I guess is an uncomfortable term for a Republican. But do you see a lack of morality here, of not making a stand against somebody that, to so many people, appears to be unqualified for the presidency and to be the nominee of this major party?
I would not agree with the phrase. I think that phrase goes too far. Vichy Republicans, the phrase that you just quoted from Mr. Fellows. And I'm also hesitant to judge another, although in public life you have to judge others from time to time. So I'll simply say that it was unacceptable for me. I could certainly have been quiet. I'm a former congressman, right? I'm a professor now. It's my privilege to be a teacher. And what I thought of is the model that I set as a teacher for my students about speaking the truth and not taking an easy path when there is something very, very important that compels a more difficult path. So just speaking for myself, yes, my conscience did not permit me to remain silent. It would have been perhaps a quieter life if I had remained silent. The conscience issue in my case was, can I look my students straight in the eye after the election, and if one of them says, what did you do when you were presented with an individual running for president in the Republican Party, from the Republican Party, who made reference to violence in connection with the Democratic nominee, who said troops should be allowed to torture, who encouraged people to use violence at rallies, what did you do? And I simply could not remain silent and anticipate answering those students, well, I did nothing.
So how do you see the future then of the party if, as the polls indicate, and we'll see what happens on Sunday night with the second debate, but my sense of the first debate was that it's simply because it's not a soundbite-driven situation. We have somebody on stage for 90 minutes on a split screen. You actually get an opportunity to see this person. And I think the more you see Donald Trump, the less there is, if you will. And so my guess would be that he may not do well in this debate, and therefore it's more and more likely that Hillary Clinton will be the next president. Given that possibility, what do you think the post-mortem is going to be on the Republican Party? Some pundits have suggested an inexorable split between the moderate wing, the people that you represent, who wrote this letter, and the more Tea Party wing.
I think the moderate wing of the Republican Party has long been patient. It's been a long time since a moderate Republican was nominated for president. I'd have to think back to Gerald Ford, perhaps. And I do recall, however, that after Barry Goldwater, Senator Goldwater, lost in a huge landslide in 1964, the Republican Party moved back to the middle in Richard Nixon, who later, of course, was characterized as the only president to resign and obvious dissatisfaction. But remember, as of 1968, he was viewed as the moderate Republican, the centrist Republican. And so it's one I think could logically assume that the moderate wing of the Republican Party will take a long, hard look at whether a move back to the center is possible. I would not prejudge that. Indeed, if Donald Trump's loss, if that's what happens, brings down the Republican majority in the Senate and threatens the Republican majority in the House, then the pragmatic side will probably take over, even among some of the more socially conservative of the Republicans. But I would say one last thing on this. Donald Trump is in a category of his own, This is not a traditional social conservative versus social moderate or interventionist foreign policy versus isolationist foreign policy. The Republican Party has and would continue to tolerate such debates and move from one candidate to another as time to time, as I just alluded to, from Goldwater to Nixon. But this is special. This is not that debate. This is an unusually unqualified person, unconstrained by normal rules of politeness or respect in public discourse, and evidently unschooled and unwilling to be schooled in matters of public policy. And so it's distinctly possible, Ian, that at the end of this, the fiscal conservatives, the social moderates, will all come together, even with some of the Tea Party activists, and say, this was not the right candidate. Let's all agree. We need to have some minimum set of qualifications, quality, and probably need to reform the primary system where you had a dozen candidates dividing up so that the plurality winner was allowed to go on and go on, even though a majority of Republicans in those primaries did not want Donald Trump. He's the one we got. I think you probably see a consensus across the almost entire spectrum of Republican activists that the process that led to this was a mistake.
But the Republicans have enjoyed a reputation for the longest times as the more professional, suitable, if you will, stewards of national security. They've had a much deeper bench with the Brent Scowcrofts of the world, etc., in terms of the Democrats. And indeed, as somebody that's been involved with arms control and national security issues for a long time, I dealt a lot with the Russians or the Soviets going back then, and they always preferred to deal with Republicans, not with Democrats. So it's extraordinary to my mind to watch the Republican Party squander one of its best assets in terms of its deep bench of professional national security experts, and to have a candidate who's openly flirting with Vladimir Putin, who is doing extraordinary damage. Not only is he unprecedentedly interfering in our elections in what amounts to a war on our democracy, he's about to create massive refugee problems in Europe, to destabilize Europe, to weaken Europe, etc. I mean, it's not as if he's sitting back on his hands. He's actively trying to undermine U.S. and democratic values around the world. And I just find it absolutely breathtaking to watch this peculiar romance going on between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin.
It is strange. And it is why you had so many national security experts sign their own letter several weeks ago, critical of Donald Trump. And passing beyond the important issues of the Republican Party's inherent advantage on national security issues, for one moment, let's just put ourselves in the minds of the Baltic countries. If you're prime minister and president in Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia, and the United States president has cast doubt on NATO, and you have Russia or Belarus and Russia, to the extent Kaliningrad borders on the Baltics, as you know, but otherwise a very strong satellite of Russia, Belarus, right on your border. And Donald Trump has said, well, maybe I'm not going to be all that supportive of NATO. We'll see. And you look and you see Ukraine, where Putin tested, put some support in. There were troops put in without uniform, without designations on their uniforms that they were Russian. See what the reaction was. President Obama was weak in his reaction. Now we have the actual occupation following the testing. So what is likely, it seems to me, is Putin begins to test in the Baltics, because that would be the crown jewel. That would be the achievement of the abolition of the reliability of Article 5 of NATO. That is the hard premise on which international security rests, that borders are inviolate. Footnote, except apparently for Ukraine. And now there'll be another footnote, second footnote, or Georgia, southern Ossetia. And now a third footnote, if Donald Trump becomes president, maybe the Baltics. It is deadly serious. And Putin's desire to undermine NATO has not been hidden. That is the achievement of the end of American supremacy and the redemption of Russia following its humiliating end of the Soviet Union. I think Putin wants it. And I think it's incredibly hard to believe, incredibly, therefore, likely that he will try that if he has a president who is willing to look the other way or say NATO is not inviolable.
Well, just in closing, Congressman Tom Campbell, back to the post-mortem, if there is to be one, with a Trump loss and perhaps some Republican losses as well, although it's unlikely the Republicans will lose the House, there's some possibility of them losing the Senate. But in general, do you think that moderate Republicans like yourself and the others that signed this letter would be able to make a comeback, in the sense that one of the peculiar psychological aspects of politics that I've noticed is that Democrats, they hate a fellow Democrat who's slightly to the right of them more than they do Republicans further to the right of them. And on the Republican side, you have this thing called the rhinos. You have Republicans on the far right hating anybody who's slightly to the left of them. So I don't understand that psychosis, if you will, but it does seem to be a powerful one. And it would seem to me that the only way to counter it is to show some strength against this.
I've noticed the same psychosis, or the same pathology. It is odd, is it not, that primary battles are more bitter than general election battles in many, many instances, perhaps even for president at this time around. So the answer is yes, that might be an obstacle to bringing the Republican Party back together. I would say, however, and this is a reprise of what happened after 1964, that defeat is a great teacher. The opportunity to correct that which went wrong is a great motivator. And so I think it's premature to say that that will not happen. But I will recur to one important point. Who will be the leader? Who will bring the Republican Party back into a process that emphasizes qualifications, stresses our role in the world as the guarantor of NATO, emphasizes the Republican Party's deep roots in civil rights. We never would have had a civil rights law in 1964, but for the support of the Republican senators. Who will be that person? And you mentioned Paul Ryan. It's conceivable that he could, if he is not excessively tarnished by supporting Donald Trump. And if he is excessively tarnished, then the greatest impediment to this return of the Republican Party is the absence of a leader to do so.
Well, Congressman Tom Campbell, I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for asking.
And again, I've been speaking with Congressman Tom Campbell. He's a former Republican congressman who represented California's 15th congressional district from 1995 to 2000, and prior to that represented California's 12th congressional district from 1989 to 1992. He is the former dean and is now a professor at Chapman University School of Law. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with an analysis of the unusually sharp rebuke issued Wednesday by the White House and the State Department over Israel's plans to build new settlements on the West Bank. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz and a member of the newspaper's editorial board. He is the former spokesman for Shimon Peres and writes the weekly Twilight Zone feature in Haaretz, which covers the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza over the last 30 years. His latest book is The Punishment of Gaza. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gideon Levy.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And yesterday, the White House came out with a very unusual rebuke of Israel over its announcements to increase settlements just after having received a $38 billion package, a record amount in terms of military assistance And I think the interpretation amongst a lot of people is that Obama is basically being kind of stiffed by Netanyahu in the way that the Republicans basically treat him with contempt. Are we to infer that this is a sort of personal insult?
You know, Ian, it's too little and too late. I mean, for the last 7.5 years, the American administration did almost nothing to push Israel to put an end to the occupation or to stop building settlements. And now to wake up and to be mad at Israel because of some more settlements is really quite ridiculous. Because the same President Obama just signed now this check for 10 years for $70 billion to Israel in a most unconditioned way, without putting any kind of condition to Israel to, for example, stop the settlement project as a condition for getting this enormous sum of money. So now to wake up and to say, bad boy Israel, I think it's really late and quite ridiculous.
So what you're just saying, though, was sort of in many ways was reinforced by what happened at the State Department. I mean, the White House had a rebuke for this Israeli settlement deal, but also the State Department spokesman Mark Toner made a equally, annoyed kind of attitude towards this deal. But when questioned by the reporters, they said, what are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it? At the end of the day, all Mr. Toner could say, our action is that we convey to them, meaning the Israelis, both publicly and privately, and to the world, when we see Israel conducting itself in a way that runs counter to its security interests. In other words, not even a spanking. I mean, that's the part that's so extraordinary, isn't it?
That's the ridiculous part of it. It is a hollow, empty lip service, as if the United States of America couldn't have stopped the settlement project long time ago. Would the American administration really like to stop the settlement project? The settlement project would have died long time ago, because by the end of the day, Israel is not in a position to say a clear no to the United States. But after 7.5 years in which Prime Minister Netanyahu learned that he can do whatever he wants, and there's no chance that the American administration will punish him or Israel in any way. So, you know, who takes it seriously now, those empty talkings?
So you don't think that there's a public policy then and a private one, and the private one is that the priority, as far as we're concerned with Israel, is taking care of its security interests, and we'll just go along with the peace process that's, after all, a process. It's not about peace. It's about process. Is there cynicism on both sides, do you think, or the U.S. is just being weak?
I don't know how weak is the U.S. The U.S. is not so weak. The U.S. does not want, for its own reasons, to practice any kind of pressure on Israel. I don't think it is because of American weakness. I think it is a choice by the United States not to put pressure on Israel. And Israel takes advantage of it as it can. And therefore, I guess the coming months until the change in the White House, until January, will be quite unpleasant, and there will be more and more anger being expressed from them, from Washington to Jerusalem. But it will have very, very little practical meaning.
So what is the explanation then? Is it the influence of the Israeli lobby over Congress? Is it in an election year, nobody wants to come out against Israel in any way because it's going to affect the vote and certainly the funding, some of the biggest donors? Clearly, the American Jewish community is engaged in politics, perhaps more actively than most citizens. But on the other hand, you have this paradox where two-thirds of Jewish Americans vote Democrat, yet the lobby seems to represent the far right of the Republican Party and be much more in sync with Netanyahu than anybody else in Israel's political world.
I guess there's more than one answer. First of all, forget about election year, because when it comes to the policy toward Israel, it is always election year, and the administration never becomes more critical after the elections. There are always promises that maybe after the elections. I remember after Obama, President Obama finished his first term, everyone said in Israel, wait until he will be in his second term. Then he will be totally independent from the Jewish lobby, and then he will really do what he believes. And nothing happened, obviously. So forget about the election year. Forget also about explaining everything through the Jewish lobby, because I can't believe that it is so powerful that the Jewish lobby by itself can dictate the American policy. By the end of the day, it is a combination of factors. The Jewish lobby is one of the strongest ones. There is also the Christian lobby, as you know. There is the arm industry. And above all, there is also some factors which I could never understand. I don't understand until this very moment, because I think by the end of the day, the United States is playing a very strange game, not only against its values, but also against its own interests, by supporting and financing the Israeli occupation for so many years.
So that gets back to what I was saying earlier. Is there an equal amount of cynicism on the U.S. side, that it gives lip service to the Palestinians, at the same time its greater concern is Israel's security, although Israel doesn't need the help? This is the extraordinary thing about this arms package. One of the things that I find extraordinary is that a lot of the U.S. assistance that goes to Israel in the form of the latest weapons, this technology is often replicated in Israel and sold around the world, even to Russians and the Chinese. So that's the part of it that's extraordinary, is that it ends up, some of this stuff ends up not being in the overall security interests of the United States.
I go even farther than this. Israel's security is guaranteed for many years. Israel is not facing now any army, because the Arab world is busy in totally different things than Israel, as we know. And Israel is by far well-equipped, much over-equipped, I would say. And to speak about the security of Israel as if Israel is in danger is obviously a very bad joke.
Well, it's very much being spoken in this election. And not only is Donald Trump telling us our military is weak, but he's also telling us we're not standing up for Israel. So I guess this sounds a bit like your Twilight Zone, right?
Right. It is a lot of hypocrisy, a lot of lies, I must say, and a lot of slogans which were relevant once when Israel was really struggling for its existence. But Israel right now is a regional superpower with one of the biggest and strongest armies in the world. And talking about the security of Israel is really so irrelevant and so hypocritic. By the end of the day, the one whose security is really in danger are the Palestinians, who live under a brutal occupation for so many years.
And these new settlements that are closer to Jordan than they are to Israel, that's the concern expressed by both the White House spokesman and the State Department spokesman yesterday, was that it effectively makes any possible future Palestinian state essentially bifurcated, neutralized, if you will. So is this an example of what, I think we've spoken in the past about it, one of the things that I find extraordinary about the Likud right-wing position in Israel is that they never talk about their end game. They say that, and they just said yesterday that the government of Israel said that we're still engaged in a two-state solution. But if you ask anybody on the Israeli right, what is the end game, they don't give you an answer. And the end game seems to be to talk peace while grabbing more territory.
Even without talking peace, I mean, why would they bother to talk peace as long as the United States and the West is allowing Israel to continue the status quo and to build new settlements? They don't even have to bother about talking about peace. Nobody talks about peace anymore.
Well, it would seem, though, that if the situation in Syria continues to deteriorate as it does, the likely outcome is, it's worth noting that when Vladimir Putin intervened in Syria, shortly thereafter there was a massive exodus of refugees into Europe. And if the Assads win, along with Russia and Iran, isn't there likely to be a massive Sunni exodus from both Iraq and from Syria into Europe? If so, it would seem that the Europeans are going to be more preoccupied with their own xenophobic reaction to this massive influx of refugees than they are about any possible sanctions on Israel. What's your prediction in terms of pressure on Israel if the United States is not doing anything and is basically just huffing and puffing but issuing empty threats? Do you think the Europeans are going to put any pressure on, or are they going to be preoccupied with the possible fallout from what's happening in Syria?
I doubt it very much that the Europeans will do more than the Americans are doing. Don't forget that the Europeans carry also all kind of guilt feelings from the past. And they are also preoccupied with the immigrants and refugee problem and Islamophobia in Europe, which is getting stronger and stronger. And all this plays into the hands of Israel and plays into the hands of the status quo, namely continuing the occupation. The only hope right now is from civil societies, both in this country here and in Europe, when you see more and more students and more young people who raise their voice, who are not ready to accept an apartheid state in the 21st century, and hopefully they will finally be influential enough and will be able to push their governments. That's the only hope around.
So just in the last couple of minutes, Gideon Levy, since you were the former spokesman for Shimon Peres, and of course many world leaders, including President Obama, went to the funeral recently where Shimon Peres was buried next to Yitzhak Rabin, much of the punditry suggested that Peres was the last of the Israeli politicians committed to the peace process. Is that obituary premature or correct?
No, it's not correct, because also Mr. Peres' commitment to peace was mainly rhetorics and very little being done. If you look backwards, Peres spoke very nicely about peace, but did very little to put an end to the occupation. As a matter of fact, he was one of the founding fathers of the settlement project and one of the founding fathers of the Israeli occupation. So he's not the last one and he's not the first one. He had some ambition toward peace. He spoke about peace a lot. But I don't think that the peace process, for the peace process, it's a great loss that he's gone, because in the recent years he did nothing to achieve peace.
Well, is there any movement that may grow in the future in terms of young Israelis? Here in the United States in this election, we saw a kind of rediscovery of the American left, which has long been dormant, by the candidacy of Bernie Sanders. And clearly, the young people in this country are fed up with political status quo. And the word socialism has always been a dirty word in the American political lexicon. But here you have a self-declared socialist doing very well and getting quite a substantial constituency mobilized. So is there any such thing happening on the Israeli side that would indicate that all is not lost in terms of the future of a peace?
Unfortunately not. There are some courageous and devoted groups of young Israelis, but they are very small in numbers and they are being delegitimized and they are not growing, by all means, they are not growing. Our brainwash system in Israel is very effective and Israel is moving all the time only more and more toward nationalism and toward the right pole, the right wing.
And is this the influence of the Russian emigres, as Bill Clinton said? What explains this shift to the right?
It's not, I mean, the Russians are a factor, but they are a minority in Israeli society. It has nothing to do with them. It has to do with the fact that life in Israel is so good, and nobody cares about the occupation, and Israel never was taken accountable for the occupation, for the crimes. And people ignore it and live in denial and believe that the occupation can last forever and the good life in Israel will last forever. And why would they bother about the occupation?
So thus the wall that separates the two states. And I don't know. I always hate to end on. I don't mean to be a Pollyanna, but I don't like ending these conversations feeling so pessimistic. But is there any life raft you can throw us in the last minute, Gideon?
Yeah, I can tell you what I always say, that in our part of the world, one should be realistic enough to believe in miracles.
Okay, well, that's a good note to end on. I thank you for joining us.
Wonderful. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz and a member of the newspaper's editorial board. He's the former spokesman for Shimon Peres and writes the weekly Twilight Zone feature in Haaretz, which covers the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza over the last 30 years. And his latest book is The Punishment of Gaza. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether an anti-LGBT panic helped defeat Colombia's peace deal. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Brendan O'Boyle, who's an editor of America's Quarterly and policy associate at America's Society Council of the Americas. He has an article at America's Quarterly, Did an Anti-LGBT Panic Help Defeat Colombia's Peace Deal? Welcome to Background Briefing, Brendan O'Boyle.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And Brendan, some of the feedback that I've gotten just immediately following the failed referendum on the peace deal between the Colombian government and the FARC is sort of categorizing it in this inchoate, irrational populism that's going on around the world, rejection of elites, anger at the establishment manifested by the Brexit vote in the UK, and as some argue here in the United States, as exemplified by those who support Donald Trump. So you're telling us there's actually some more to this story. So let's start with the bigger picture. What do you think the biggest factors were in this unusual rejection of a peace between the government and the FARC after a 52-year civil war that cost 260,000 Colombian lives? You would think getting peace would be the number one priority of the Colombian people.
Yes, Ian, you would think that. And we still may be able to assume that most Colombians do want peace. So I think what happened on Sunday was that this deal, the government kind of assumed that the deal was more popular than it was, obviously, and that they equated a yes vote with peace. If you want peace, you vote yes. But ultimately, I think we saw that many Colombians just weren't happy with the terms of the deal. And that's one reason there was, you know, people were not happy with the possibility of not sending these leaders of the FARC to prison, which was in the deal. And I think the government just underestimated the distaste for the FARC. After 52 years, like you mentioned, many Colombians, I think half of all Colombians have lost a family member to violence in this conflict. So it was going to take a really good deal for it to pass, and I think they underestimated the kind of deal. And then, of course, you have several other reasons, and like in my article, you've got the influence of the religious right that I spoke about.
Well, I want to get into that, obviously. Yes. But one of the things that I understood perhaps explains, first of all, there was some bad weather from a hurricane that supposedly kept the turnout down. It was an all-time low, I think, 37%.
Yeah.
And that was a great puzzlement. But is another factor that, in a sense, when the deal was announced, the peace deal was announced, the referendum was basically yes or no in terms of the peace deal. But the consequences of voting no were not a resumption of civil war. And had that been the consequences of a no vote, surely you would have had a different outcome.
Right. And the leaders of the no vote, like former president and now Senator Álvaro Uribe, have presented the option of a renegotiation of the deal. So their argument was that we still want peace and we can end this war, but it doesn't have to be on the terms of the government.
Well, that is, I guess, explains then why people don't have that urgency, that sense that, you know, and why did the FARC then go along with a deal that where they lost the leverage of going back to war?
I know that it took 4 years of negotiations for this deal, so you could make the argument that the government conceded too much to the FARC. Obviously, many opponents of the deal also think that, but I'm just not sure.
Well, it seems like the FARC actually made bigger concessions if they took away the leverage of resuming the war, or are they just so depleted their ranks and so tired of after 52 years in the jungle that they simply, you know, they want to put a good face on defeat?
Certainly after 52 years, they have incentives to end the fighting. And I think this is the peace deal was the smartest way for them to, you know, pursue their own personal agenda without considering the fighting. But we'll see what happens now that it's rejected.
And again, I'm speaking with Brendan O'Boyle, who's an editor of America's Quarterly and a policy associate of America's Society Council of the Americas. He has an article at America's Quarterly, Did an Anti-LGBT Panic Help Defeat Colombia's Peace Deal? So let's look into what you've written in your article. Let's talk about Colombia's now ex-minister of education, Gina Parodi. She seems to have been the kind of poster girl for this backlash.
Certainly. When this whole controversy erupted back in August, it was something that social conservatives and leaders of groups that are anti-LGBT inclusion and anti-LGBT rights sort of jumped on. But I would say, in my own opinion, that the controversy was unfairly sort of linked to her, in that the teacher's handbook that circulated online, which made a lot of people angry, which had language about the gender not being linked to your biological sex, that was a project produced in part with the Ministry of Education, which Parodi was leading at the time, but it was also drafted in partnership with international agencies, which many Colombians did not sort of want to see. They put it all on her, and she took the blame. Also, this guidebook that went viral online, it was a draft, and it wasn't even something that the government had published yet. So, and it was open for revision. So it really shows you when something goes viral online and people have a chance to spout their opinion, it's like a game of telephone. Things get changed. There's a lot of information out there, misinformation, and it became sort of a smear campaign against the Minister Parodi.
So the controversy began early this year when this draft of this teaching handbook, which was produced by the Education Ministry, headed by Gina Parodi, who is she's a self-identified lesbian, is she not?
Yes, she's one of the only openly LGBT politicians in the government at the time.
Right. But this was done in tandem with her ministry, the Education Ministry in Colombia, and international agencies, including UNICEF, And then this particular sentence that caused this this jihad against her is, one isn't born a man or a woman, but rather learns to be one according to the society and age in which they grow up. Now, how did this furor bringing out the conservative, with the conservative backlash that it produced in Colombia, how does it tie in to the referendum last Sunday?
Absolutely. Well, that, as you mentioned, that that sentence itself sort of blew up. And it also came along with lots of internet memes and also fake versions of this student guidebook. So you had a lot of upset people, a lot of upset social conservatives, members of evangelical Christian churches, and some of the more radical Catholics in the countries, who were receiving misinformation, and they were being told by leaders of certain groups that this, that the minister Prodi was on some kind of mission to indoctrinate their children with what, with a term that is being, that's used throughout Latin America called the ideology of gender, which is used by many social conservative groups to sort of describe the basically gender studies and anything that doesn't sort of align with fixed gender roles that would relate to sexual orientation, gender expression. And so there was a big protest in August. It came just a few days after this whole controversy erupted, and it kind of was lost in the news because everyone was paying attention to the peace accords as well as the Olympics at the time. And but what you had was protests throughout the country, which were called the March for the Family, sort of equating the handbook and Prodi's policies with an attack on the quote-unquote traditional family. And so I think the biggest protest was in the city of Bucaramanga, and that drew between 25 and 30,000 people. And if you look at pictures from the protests, it's a lot of, you've got signs that talk about the danger of same-sex marriage and calling for Prodi's resignation. And on first glance, it doesn't have anything to do with the peace accord. But what we saw was when former President Uribe, he sort of joined the conversation. And if you've been following the peace accord, you know that Uribe was the leader of the opposition to the accord. And he tweeted out a tweet about this student handbook, and he sort of let it be known that he was against this whole, he was on the side of the social conservatives that were out protesting. And that all of a sudden sort of made this, it brought this into the realm of the opposition. And then also it's important to note in the peace accords, you've got a historic inclusion of gender, as well as the issue of reparations for women specifically, and also LGBT people. It's never been done in a peace accord, in a peace deal internationally, the inclusion of LGBT people. So it made it, it was a landmark deal, but what you had was some of these leaders that were for, that they recognized how angry people were about this gender ideology controversy, and they sort of pointed out into the peace accord, hey, look, it talks about gender. It's an effort to impose gender ideology by way of a peace deal. And of course, it's an argument, but it doesn't say anything about gender ideology in the peace accords. But nonetheless, that whole, you know, it was a political move by opponents of the deal to sort of capitalize on this sort of outrage.
Sure, but surely it didn't help that bowing to this kind of pressure led by Uribe and others who are against the education minister, and Uribe, of course, was the leader of the No campaign, mm-hmm. that the president, Santos, on August the 30th, he removed Gina Parodi from the education ministry and made her a coordinator of the Yes campaign for the FARC peace deal. So surely right. that was what where this element that we're talking about came was brought into the rejection of the peace deal. In other words, he just handed Uribe a gift, didn't he?
You really have to wonder what he was thinking. It just doesn't really compute. Parodi has been one of the most unpopular ministers of his presidency, and she's in the outrage, you know, the controversy over the student handbooks didn't help. And to think that he would then put her in charge of the Yes campaign, or make her coordinator of the Yes campaign, makes you scratch your head.
Well, the results were pretty devastating. So clearly, with the weather, with the sense that there wasn't going to be any punishment if you voted against it, and nobody mm-hmm. likes the FARC, and therefore they thought, well, we'll get a better deal because we're not happy with this deal. You know, just in closing, what kind of, is there any way you can, you know, enumerate these factors? I mean, obviously this LGBT issue is a part of the mix.
It's certainly a part of the mix. And I think that the result on Sunday was an example of the way that the right throughout the world in 2016 has shown itself to be just more energized and more organized than the left. In Colombia, that was certainly the case. You had Uribe and the church really firing people up against this vote. And, you know, I say the church, but I mean these factors, these sectors of the religious right.
Family values.
You had in his first remarks after the vote, Uribe came out and said, we want a new deal that reflects our family values. And it just shows that even for him, you know, at the center of this,
right.
you know, is so much yeah. more than the peace deal.
Thank you so much for joining us, Brendan O'Boyle.
Thank you, Ian. I really appreciate it.
And again, Brendan O'Boyle is an editor of America's Quarterly and a policy associate at America's Society Council of the Americas. He has an article at America's Quarterly, Did an Anti-LGBT Panic Help Defeat Colombia's Peace Deal? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.